det är en sån här. So I've been following doctor's orders as much as possible. Doctors meaning DR, meaning Dharmishtha Rajgiriyans. Doctor's orders is to try and not speak, give my voice box as much rest as possible. Some of our doctors have been giving me prescriptions, others have been dropping off their spare strepsils, other doctors have been handing out various bits of advice and all sorts. I'm just overwhelmed by the love, affection and care of our doctors. So, thank you. But as I say, there's no rest for the wicked. So I must be pretty wicked. There's one part of me that hardly gets any rest. And you know what part that is. It's part of the job. It's part of who I am, and it's part of what makes me who I am. If there was a way I could convey my thoughts, what I want to express to you telepathically, I would, but there is only one way in which I can express myself as clearly and as succinctly as I would like to. I have tried written form, but it doesn't have the same impact, unfortunately. So people have invited me to write what I have understood and what I have learned from my teachers. And although I have made efforts in the past, and I will perhaps continue to do so when I get the time, I feel that what's most impactful and what's most effective is to speak to a person face to face. And then there's of course no other way to do it than to exert my vocal cords. So here we are. What's best is that I didn't bother saying that, because that would have saved me, saved my voice a little bit. But hey, this is the way it is going to be, so rock and roll. It's what we have to do. I just want you to make every word count. That's all I can ask from you. Just make sure that every word counts. Every day of our visiting here, all the effort that we all put in, from the Swami says to the Anagarika Mahathyas who drive us here carefully, ensure that we get here on time and get back to the monastery safe, to my teacher who has entrusted me and given me the freedom to visit you every week and share with you what I have learned from him, to the monastery. Because, you know, as I say, great men are great because they stand on the shoulders of men who are greater than them. So if you think I'm good, if you think I'm great, that's because I'm only standing on the shoulders of those who are greater than me. They can not only bear themselves, but they can also bear me. That is why I consider them to be my guiding light. So all of this, as you know, is a very collective effort. Everyone contributes something. There's no one that doesn't contribute anything. Everyone contributes something. And it's that collective contribution that makes all of this happen. Nibbana is not something that we can do alone. It requires selfless commitment from those who are on the path to Nibbana, as well as those who encourage others to do that, those who extend their blessings, those who extend their well wishes. So I'm here for one and for all. And I'm here because of one and because of all. So all I want you to do is to make every word count. every ounce of energy, make it count. Make it matter. And you know how best to do that. It is by not just listening to these talks, these sermons, not just merely understanding them, not mere comprehension, but also making it part and parcel of who you are. Allow that transformation to happen. Embrace that transformation. Not just hear the message, but be the message. And if we can do that, if we can all commit to do that, then this is a small price to pay. A very small price to pay. If you don't sacrifice something, you can't get something bigger and better than that, can you? You've got to sacrifice something. The best things in life are achieved when you make sacrifices. Your parents sacrificed so much for you. That is why today you are who you are. You have become successful. You live as honorable citizens of this great nation. You live respectable lives. People admire you. People look up to you. This is not an individual doing. It's a collective effort of your parents, your teachers, siblings, friends, your relations, those who did good unto you as well as those who made life difficult for you at times. Yeah? Everyone had some part to play. What makes a waterfall? It's not just the source of the water that can spring all the water you like, but to make it as beautiful as a waterfall, it is all those challenges and all those obstacles. The rocks that pool the water, as well as the great heights that allow the water to come crashing down from above. All of that collectively makes the waterfall as beautiful as it is. Those ups and downs. So there are always petty sacrifices. They are petty in the face of what they finally contribute to produce in the end. Therefore, if I am of the faith and belief that, ladies and gentlemen, in this room we can produce sotapannas, that from this audience we can produce sakrudagamis, anagamis, and finally arahants, then there's no price that I'm not willing to pay for that. I'm prepared to give my life for that. Because the arahant here is as important as the arahant in your hearts. There's no difference there. That's why I say, make every word count. Make every day count. Make every minute count. You're already doing a lot. You're coming all this way. You've given up your Sunday mornings to be here. Now, certain days it's not just a Sunday morning, it's a Sunday afternoon, right? Sunday evenings. It's kind of like 1/7 of your week is now devoted to the sasana, isn't it? The sasana is not the temples, it's not the shrine rooms, it's not the statues. The sasana is what happens within you. That is what the sasana is. Sabbhavapa sakarana. That is the sasana. If today you have given up some of the sins that you used to do, some of the wrongdoings that you used to do, some of the misdeeds that you used to commit, but you have now given it up, it's a chapter that you once read and it's long gone. You don't remember the last time you committed a sin. You don't remember the last time you took another's life, or stole something from someone, or said any harsh words, spoke the untruth. If you can't remember those days now, that's a huge victory. That is one part of the sasana done. And long may you continue that unblemished trek of your virtue. Long may that continue. And if you are now beginning to do more merits than you ever imagined you were possible, it was possible for you to do. Things that never crossed your mind. But now it has become second nature. Today, you know, it might be that those days the only merits you did was on a poya day, you went to the temple. Perhaps that was all you did. But today, when you wake up in the morning, before you take your water, you offer a water to the Buddha. And then perhaps if you have your parents with you, you offer a glass of water to your mother, to your father. Before you leave home, You get down on your knees and you worship them and take their blessings. You help out with the chores at home as a young boy or girl, if that is what you do now. If you have become more considerate towards others, if you have become more humane, if you have begun to understand that there's a lot of goodness that lives in your heart, if you have become more charitable, more generous, more patient, a softer person than you ever thought you were possible of becoming. If those days people feared your presence, but today they look forward to it, right? Then that's a huge victory. That's because you are now doing kusal. You're doing merit. And kusala supasampada. That's happening. So that is one part of the sasana. And then, if in your heart you have found more peace than you used to have, if you're more tranquil, if in the face of challenges, in the face of storms, you're able to remain calm, maintain your composure, and not let those things ruffle your feathers as much as it used to. If in the face of adversity, when people accuse you, blame you, fault you, especially when it's not your fault, you're able to just accept all that and understand that it is only a hurt man who hurts another, and therefore you look at them with compassion. If these things are happening within you, then that is the sasana. Sachitta pariyodhabana. So if you are going through this transformation, then name anything that is not worth paying for that. There's not a single cell in my body that I'm not prepared to sacrifice if you can promise me that you will continue doing that. That's it. So then this is a very small price to pay. Let's make every word count. Yeah? Good. Right, let's get started then. Let's bring our palms together and make our veneration to the Perfect One, the Magnificent One, the Omniscient One, reminding ourselves that it is in the footsteps of our forefathers today we tread steadfast, in the firm determination that we will continue this journey with resolve and fervitude until we attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana, reminding ourselves that this mark of veneration is not a mere display of our obeisance, but a pledge of our allegiance to the Buddha, Dhamma and the Sangha, which represent the truth, the path to the truth and the practice that we must all undertake to attain that truth. So with that in mind, let us make this namaskar. Let us also take this opportunity to observe the precepts, reminding ourselves of our virtues and our conduct that is conducive to our practice. And then let us also invite this countless sentient beings so that they can be amongst us, witness this wonderful meritorious deed as it unfolds, listen to the teaching of the great master, and rejoice in both the meritorious deed as well as the Dhamma that they will hear. And finally, let us resolve that may all this contribute to one and all an Anibbana for here and for now. So with that in mind, let's make a start with today's proceedings.
Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa.
I want to give you a compliment before I begin. In one of our recent talks, we had with us in the audience two individuals who were luminaries in their respective fields, And it's of interest and importance to you because that particular field in which they have demonstrated their eminence is psychology. Professors, doctors and the likes. So at the end of the talk, I had an opportunity to, they came up to me to speak a few words. And what they told me was, Swami Nohan sir, this audience that you have here, to us they seem like people who have come from many walks, many different walks of life. Some young, some younger. But despite whatever differences we perceived, they must be very intelligent and they must be very wise. Which, of course, I already knew. But I wanted to know why they thought that. So naturally, I asked them the question. I asked them, why did you think like that, sir? Sir, madam, why did you... What made you think like that? They said, Swami Nasa, this is... We've heard one of two of your talks online before. We'd heard them online before. But we really wanted to come and listen to you in person. And so we did. They said, we have to confess, Swami Nasa, that we are very new to the Dhamma, to the doctrine that you share with us. But we have learned psychology and we know it like the back of our hands. We have written books on the subject. We give lectures on the subjects. So, it is psychology is nothing new to me. But as I listen to your talks, I realized that there was a truth in there that no book has ever taught me. No lecturer had ever enlightened me. In the many years and decades of me having learned and studied this teaching, this knowledge that we refer to as psychology, we have never come across such truths. So simple yet so profound. And they said, we understood some of it, Swami Nohan sir. We have to say, this is in their words, they said, we understood some of it, but much of it just went over my head. But just because it went over my head, I don't deny that it is not the truth. What I realized, Swami Nohan sir, as I listened to your talk was, you do need a lot of intelligence and wisdom to understand this. Perhaps it is something that I personally don't have yet. I repeat to you, I quote the words of those eminent psychologists who were in this audience, and this is the feedback they gave to me at the end. So I said, then why do you think this? Why did you think about this audience? What warranted that comment? They said, well, you spoke to them, and from the way you spoke to them, I gathered that these are regular people. They must be coming here every day. And then as I spent time talking to them and seeing how they get along with each other, I figured that this must be a regular community of individuals who come together, gather here every Sunday perhaps. So then for them to be coming here every day, at least every Sunday, and then to be on this journey with you, to be able to listen to, because they said we were sat in the audience and we were looking either side, particularly when we couldn't grasp the essence of what you were saying. We understood the words but not the wisdom behind it. And then we were looking either side of us and people were like, oh yeah, that makes sense. You were throwing questions at us, Swami Nohan, and we were dumbfounded. We didn't know what the answers were. And then people were just throwing so freely answers back at you and they were nodding away. And then you asked us several times, do you understand? And then people either side were like, yep, got it, yeah. Whereas we were like, what? So what they said was, what they'd gathered from that was for you to be able to, with such conviction, be able to listen to this teaching, these talks, and sort of embrace them so eloquently and so fluently, just gave them the impression that you must be superstars. And it spoke volumes, ladies and gentlemen, about your wisdom, your intelligence, and something that they don't understand yet, your merits. Because what they were saying is, we've had decades of studying the mind, at least what we think is the mind, the brain, the psychology, the psyche, and we couldn't understand half of what you said. But in those words, we figured there must be some wisdom. It's just we haven't got the maturity yet to understand that. But then there was an audience of people here who were listening to you, and they were just nodding their heads away. Either... No, they didn't say that. They didn't say that. They had only nice things and good things and appreciation for all of you. But I reassured them. I said, you know, everyone starts like that. Right? Everyone starts off like that. Many people have come here, I said, sir, many people have come here with preconceptions of what Buddhism is, what the Buddha was, or who the Buddha was, and his teaching, and the Four Noble Truths, and the Noble Eightfold Path, and all these things. And they come here with preconceived ideas about meditation and mindfulness and so on. I told them, sir, you know, the one thing that stands this audience out from many others that I've on occasion spoken to, if I could put it in one word, sir, it would be open-minded. They have always allowed their teacher to overwrite whatever they have come here with. So everyone came here with some baggage, but they were prepared to let the teacher challenge them and put those preconceptions to a side and consider another perspective. And that is why, to this day, they are here. Because they were not here adamant, they were not here stubborn, they were not here to test the teacher, they were here to test the teaching. And that is really quite an honor that you have all earned for yourselves. You know, these are individuals who spend their lives in classrooms, lecture halls, laboratories, universities, seminars, right? Studying the psyche, or at least what they think is the human mind. And then for you to get such credit from them, I mean, you know, that is just the proof is in the pudding, shall we say. I sometimes, you know, when we go into the depths of the teaching, the Dhamma, I look around the room just to see if there are any newcomers, new faces, because I know that if I now start treading that way, it'll be quite challenging for them. But if I see only regulars, then there are no holes barred. I will just go freely. With my hands behind my back, I will just ride away, because I know that even if you don't understand all of it, you are in this journey together, which means you understand that all you lack is a bit of merits. So you will do those merits. And then you will go back and listen to the talk again. And you will come back here again. And if you don't have wisdom, you will help those who have wisdom to spread wisdom. And you understand the dynamics of all of that, the ecosystem that makes all this happen. Because you understand that, the ethos of all of this, it's just a matter of time before you understand it. So, you know, it's not just a face. You are not just a face. You are a mission. You yourself, you are a mission, ladies and gentlemen. You're not just a face. You are not just some random person off the street who's just come in here on a Sunday morning, sit down here to listen to a talk. So much has happened and so much is happening within you right now. And because it's going on every day inside you, sometimes you forget it and you take it for granted. But you know, you're now like an engine that's revved up and running at quite a fast pace. Sometimes I'm baffled myself as to how you can actually understand some of these things that I share with you. But I want you to be reassured then that there are those individuals who have gone to the pinnacle of their careers, pinnacle of their academic careers, and yet they struggle to understand some of these concepts. Perhaps in here we might have some individuals who've not even studied past grade 8. Perhaps. Yet you're here and you understand what we're talking about. When I say that there is no such thing called happiness, you go, yep, got that. And then the next word I will say is, let's all strive for happiness. And you go, yep, got that as well. See how in the same breath I can say two contrasting things. And you will understand in exactly how I meant it, and you will take it the way that I actually intended it. That's not just knowledge. That is wisdom. That is wisdom. So kudos to all of you. These are not my words. I'm conveying to you words of very educated individuals who have come here, spent time with you, observed your behaviors, and they still see, you know, that's the other part of this. Despite all that, they admiring your wisdom and your intelligence and all that, you know, they still experience the love, compassion and affection that you have towards each other and one another. You haven't lost that part, which is beautiful. You know, truly, that gets my vote. The fact that inside of you is just pure wisdom, but on the outside, it's pure compassion. That is not a combination you see every day, I have to say. Truly, it's not a combination you see every day. Here's what you typically see. You see compassion on the outside, but inside, it's just empty. So they will be compassionate as much as they can, but they will always have their limits. Those limits are the limits that are self-driven, self-imposed, because there's a self. And they don't understand that their self is only self-perceived. Those are what we call good people. Good people are good at good times. Then there are the others who have a lot of knowledge of the Dhamma. You may have come across these people as well. They understand a lot of Dhamma, but the Dhamma hasn't transformed them inside. So they will walk around, sometimes even preaching the Dhamma, teaching the Dhamma, trying to impress others with their understanding of the Dhamma. And yet, they're the last people you would want to spend a day with, because all that Dhamma is only on the inside. They have no compassion, no kindness, no mercy, nothing on the outside. They make you feel like you're just scum, the scum of the earth. That is not a good combination either. In fact, that's one of the worst. So what's best is when you have both of these together. Good on the outside, golden on the inside. If you can be that which is what you have become, then that is truly admirable, ladies and gentlemen. So, not from my words, but words of those who have come here, been amongst you and observed you, I wanted to convey these compliments to you, because I think you deserve it. So well done. You have become truly a community who I am proud to say I am part of. You worked hard for that. I don't say that very often. As a monk, I don't say that very often. You have worked hard to become a community I consider myself proud to be associated with. Well done. So, let's get into the depths of the Dhamma. You earned it. Now, it's time to feed you. Right, get your plates out. It's time to serve. Cutlery ready? I want to explore further this thing we talked about last week. The fact that there is no such thing called happiness. And how in the Buddha's first sermon, his first discourse, he revealed this to us when he said, these are the four noble truths of, now let's not put the word suffering, although it is anglicized as suffering. Dukkha is not suffering anymore. At least not in your minds, it should be something. It's not suffering anymore. So when the Buddha says dukkha, we used to think that he was referring to suffering. I trust that we have come to a point where we understand that these two things are not one and the same. This was the Pali term that he used, which was the language that he used that was available at the time. There were many languages, but this was the language that he chose to preach the Dhamma. This has translated to Sinhalese as dukkha, which is a very common term. Whenever you're not happy about something, you say, I'm very madhari dukkai. I'm sad. See, dukkha in Sinhalese translates to sad. Or sadness. Isn't it? So you are either happy, madhari satutui, or sad, madhari dukkai. So we are very familiar with this word dukkha. And therefore when you hear one day that the Buddha gave this sermon in the deer park, and it is said that he spoke the four noble truths, and then you ask, what were those four noble truths? And he said that he spoke about the first noble truth of suffering. Immediately you think, ah, now I found someone who understands me. It is true what you just said, but not in the way that you meant it. You have found someone who understands me. Yes. That is true. But what do you mean by me? Can you see this? At the back? Can you see what I'm writing on the board? So-so? I will read it out as I write it. So in your mental board, you just jot it down, okay? Me. Bad color. Maybe red? Would that work better? Black? Okay. Yes? Okay. So when you hear, you know, read in a book, hear from a teacher, wherever, that the Buddha spoke of suffering. And that is what you've been going through all your life. Suffering for this, suffering for that, suffering for whatever. Your friends make you suffer, your parents make you suffer, your siblings make you suffer, your spouse make you suffer. Everything makes you suffer. So when you hear that the Buddha spoke of the four noble truths of suffering, then you have this moment of joy that someone, finally I've met someone who understands me. Someone who understands what I'm going through right now. Like I said, it's true that it is me that someone has understood, but it's not the same me that you're talking about. What happened somewhere along the line was this dukkha became suffering, and suffering in Sinhalese became sadness. So this is dukkai, English suffering. Pali, dukkha, because of the similarity between these two words, people assume that the Buddha spoke of suffering. The suffering that you experience when you go through life, the downs of life more so than the ups of life. When you're hurt, when you're disappointed, when you're grieving, when you're going through sorrow and pain and anguish, right? These emotional responses that we have to things in life, those negative emotions, as we say, those negative emotions we put into a into one big box, and we put the word dukkha in that. And then, when you see that the Buddha referred to the Four Noble Truths of suffering, immediately you assume that this is what the Buddha spoke of. But the thing is, ladies and gentlemen, nothing could be further from the truth. It is not what he spoke of. The dukkha that you experience, or the suffering, or the sadness that you experience, is a byproduct of the dukkha that he spoke of. It is not the dukkha that he spoke of, it's a byproduct of that. This dukkha is also referred to in the Paticchasamuppada as what? Jati. In the Paticchasamuppada, dependent origination process, this dukkha is referred to as jati. Jati is not the only dukkha. Jati is one example of a dukkha. Jati is not the only dukkha. Jati is also a dukkha. Okay? But jati is not the only dukkha. See, this is also a dukkha. This is also a dukkha. This is also a dukkha. And the hand that's holding it is also a dukkha. Now, you must not think I call these all dukkhas because they are impermanent. They wither away, they break, they're destroyed over time, right? And they perish. That is not what I mean by that. The word dukkha I probably translated it as something as no, I'm not going to do that. Let's keep it at dukkha and let's try and understand what dukkha means. Because the moment you give it another word, there will be various connotations to that. And the same problem that happened once will happen again. Because whatever word I throw at you, it'll be a word from the dictionary. And the problem with words in the dictionary is everyone understands a slightly different interpretation of that word. So whatever you say, I say cat, you'll think, oh, the cat that I have at home. Someone else thinks the cat, you know, those big bulldozers, they're also cats, right? So one thing is that. So instead of giving you another term to remember, perhaps it's better just to make sure that we understand what it means. And then it doesn't matter what you call it, whether it's dukkha, whatever. So we are now at a point where I say that dukkha is not the sadness. So sadness encapsulates all these other negative emotions, okay? Like worry, fear, anguish, pain, disappointment, da-di-da-di-da, all that is in there. Dukkha, and I say jati is one example, one instance of dukkha. It is not the be-all and end-all of dukkha. See, do you remember in the Paticchasamuppada he says, jatipi, what? Dukkha. And then next he says, jarapi dukkha. See, if jati is the only dukkha, then how can then he go on to say then jarapi, jara is also dukkha? Vyadipi dukkha, maranampi dukkha, sankittena panchupadana kanda dukkha. See, all of these are dukkhas. Not sadness, not suffering either. These are dukkhas. Now there's no point in me going like this, these are dukkhas. What is that? That's like andare kirikaya vage, right? Oh, andaya. Like you have the blind man ate milk, curd, sorry. You've heard that story? Have you heard that story? So there was this blind man once. And they came and asked him, what is white? They were asked to explain the color white. So he asked, what does white mean? And he says, white? It's just white. you know, white like a swan. What's a swan? A swan is like these things. So he put his hand out and touched him like this. Ah, so that is what white is. So he walks away thinking that that is what white is. The same thing happens if I try and give you substitutes for these words instead of actually getting the meaning behind it across to you. Because once you get the meaning, then it doesn't matter what word you use to refer to it. So, coming back to our point, jatipi dukkha. Jati is a dukkha. Jara is a dukkha. Vyadi is a dukkha. Marana is a dukkha. Now, what are the four terms that we are familiar with for this jati, jara, vyadi, marana? What are the words you are more accustomed to hearing? Jati, birth. See what happened, right? Then you will understand where we all lost lost our tracks. Jati we translate it to as birth. So then immediately you think about a child being born. Childbirth. So a child could be a human child, it could be some other animal, right? Then birth is suffering. So then when people say birth is suffering, what are some examples they bring up? They say, haven't you seen how a child cries when they are born? Right? Defenseless, helpless. A child is helpless when they are born. All you can see is them crying. Of course it's suffering, isn't it? See, again, you nicely connect those two things together and say, that's why the Buddha said that birth is suffering. So if that is suffering, why does everyone party? I mean, that's, you can't get more evil and wicked than that, can you? Like someone suffering out there and people, the rest of them are throwing a party. Isn't it? So the parents are throwing a party while the child is suffering. The relations are throwing a party while the child is suffering. I mean, that's so wicked. So heartless. So now you have this conflict. So the Buddha says that birth is suffering, and I can see that the child is crying when the child is born. And then the other things you will say is, well, you know, what if the child is deformed? Right? All sorts of things could happen during childbirth. All sorts of things could happen during pregnancy. Right? So then, of course, birth is a very risky process. Right? Anything could happen. So therefore, it is inherently sufferable. So I'm sharing with you, or reminding you rather, some of the thoughts and the teachings and the sentiments that we grew up with, thinking that is what suffering is. But then the thing is, that suffering ends the moment you are born, isn't it? So jatipi dukkha happens how many times in your life? I mean, according to conventional teachings, right? And no one's at fault, no one's to blame for this, you know, besides our lack of merits. Isn't it? If you're hungry, don't blame the chef. If the food's not nice, don't blame the chef. If the music's not nice, don't blame the violinist. Don't blame the artist. It's because you just don't have the merits to listen to something nice, to eat something nice. Right? We are gone and past those days where we pointed fingers at others, right? Aren't we all there now? Doctors? Yes. Where are we now? We are at a point where if ever something's not right, we bring it back home. And whenever something is right, again we bring it back home and recognize that this is only conditioned. Therefore, we can't go hang our hats on it. You never know what point the causes will change, and therefore a different effect might manifest. Therefore, we are the last people to take things for granted. Aren't we? Aren't we? We are the last people to take things for granted because we know that nothing comes served on a plate, nothing comes for granted. All of this is the effect or this is the labor of hard work. Yeah? Okay. So then, once again I ask you the question. Jatipi dukkha happens how many times in your life? Conventionally. From what you've learned. Once. Because once you're born, that's it. Problem's done. Sorted. Now you just have to hope that you can live for as long as you can, because there's another one coming at the end. What's the other one? Maranampi dukkha. Death is suffering. So people don't. So people believe that they can sandwich themselves between these two dukkhas, jati and marana, and not worry about it after it's happened. And besides, you know, people, you know, they say maranampi dukkha and all that, but you know, you don't even know you're dead. You're dying, right? After you're dead, you're dead. And then the moment after you're born. So actually, these two sufferings, you know, they are the most briefly experienced sufferings of all time. Because the moment of birth and the moment of death are so transient and so momentary that you need not worry about them at all. I mean, if you follow the conventional, traditional way of thinking, then you can actually discount two of those dukkhas. And you wonder, why did the Buddha even talk about it? Jatipi dukkha and manipi dukkha, he should have just put it into the appendix. Rather than actually mention it in the main discourse. And then we have another two. Right, so now we understand jati at the point of birth, marana at the point of death, but now you have a life which you have to get through. Then you have jara and vyadi. So, then one is to do with ill health, poor health. Vyadi. So that we feel we go through when we are sick, when we are not well. But when we feel healthy, when we are actually healthy, right? You are in good health, you've gone to the doctor, you got your blood test done, you've got your full blood reports and your urines and your this and your that, and it's all good. He's given you the green light. Now, no vyadi dukkha. Right? So it gives us this impression that although the Buddha spoke of this suffering, it's quite possible to live without it. It paints the Buddha in a very negative image, doesn't it? I mean, I'm sure that there are plenty of people out there who think of the Buddha as the most pessimistic individual to have ever walked the surface of this earth. The first thing he says after he becomes a Buddha is suffering, 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 suffering. I mean, you could be forgiven for someone asking, come on, there's so much optimism in life. Why should I be a follower of someone who's just always so doom and so gloom and oh my God, so pessimistic? Why? When there are so many things to be happy about and joyful about, you know, the sun's up in the sky, the sun is bright and shining, and you know, the birds are flying, and they're tweety beeches, and the butterflies are everywhere, the flowers have blossomed, and there are children playing here and there, right? Life is good, right? There's food on the plate, and then there's the Buddha. So negative. This is one reason why people dislike Buddhist teachings. It is how they have interpreted Buddhist teachings. Again, you know, we could point our fingers at the syllabus, school textbooks, and the teachers, and the education system, but what's the point? We must always remember that when we point one finger outwards, three are pointing back at us. This might be the environment, but the causes, raga, dvesha and moha, they are with us. That we tend to forget. So it is purely down to our lack of merits. We didn't come across a teaching that was more profound than that. That was more comprehensive. That was more enlightening, and that was more mind-opening. Eye-opening even. But now, we can consider these truths. And we can re-examine what we have learned. Some of the stuff we have to unlearn, maybe, and then relearn. Half the time, You know, I come here with a pencil. On one side is the graphite, on the other side is the rubber. Half the time when I come to these sermons, that's what I have to do. So half the time I'm doing this, and the other half I'm doing this. Is to remind people and to show people that some of the baggage that they bring, there's a problem with that. So you have to erase that before you can put in something of value and something of substance. So, Vyadi, when you're sick, so then when they get measles, when they get chicken pox, when they get a cold, when they have a fever, right? Something or the other, they say, ah, see, this is suffering. I get that. I, for one, used to think, perhaps people back then were so dumb, right, that they needed a Buddha to come and remind them that sickness was suffering. So, you know, I honestly thought that people must have been so dumb, so stupid, that they needed a whole Buddha, right, 6'5", all of a Buddha, to come and teach human beings that when you are sick, you suffer. Apparently people didn't know that back then. So those days, perhaps when people had a splitting headache or a runny nose, right, or they had blisters and bumps all over their bodies, maybe before the Buddha came and taught the Dhamma, they were like partying and they were singing and dancing and jumping around, right, just enjoying life. Because they didn't realize that it was suffering, so the Buddha came and said, hey, you have to suffer. Come on, it's a time to suffer. And so they retreated into their beds, right? Went under their sheets and they suffered. Until then, illness was not suffering. Until then, people were happy about suffering. But the Buddha came around and he just spoiled it for everyone. He said, no, illness is suffering. Come on, go suffer. Go back home and suffer. So that's how stupid people were, apparently. We are the smart ones. They were just so stupid. And then old age. Jara api dukkha. This is the other one, right? Old age. So then by that translation, only half of you, maybe a third of you in this room are really worried about that. At least a half of you are like, nah, jara? Nah, not for me. I'm still young, I'm still energetic, I'm still youthful. Look at me, what jara? Don't say jara, things like that. Isn't it? So when does jara strike you? After? 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s? Huh? So it's north of at least 50, 60, right? Not before then. I mean, you have your youthful teens, right? Then your ambitious 20s, and then your adventurous 30s, and your naughty 40s. But it's only when you come to your 50s and 60s, that's when jara. That's because your skin starts to go all, what's the word? Wrinkly, yes. Right? And the substances that you should try and keep inside always starts leaking out. Right? So those orifices you can't close on your own. Right? So then now it's very jara. And you start to smell. You can't get yourself up on your own. You need help. Right? And people don't look at you as much as they used to. The hairs on your head start going grey. Right? You can't hold your wind inside, it always passes out. It's like, I'm here. Always marking your attendance. I'm here. I'm here. Now you don't need to eat Brussels sprouts for that anymore. You're always like that. Isn't it? So now it's jara. But while you're growing up, you know, while you're 6 and going up to 16, that's not jara. Is it? That's not jara. See? So then you might wonder, so the Buddha missed that part, didn't he? See, why did he not talk about the youthful, energetic, vibrant, charismatic years of our young and, you know, lives? Why did he not talk about that? When we are all very juvenile and very strong and, you know, with boundless energy, jumping around and very sporty and, you know, running around, doing everything that we wanted to do. Why did the Buddha miss that in the four truths? Why did he only speak about suffering? No wonder then people come to the conclusion that he was such a pessimist. All he saw when he opened his Buddha eyes and looked at the world was how people suffer. How come he missed how much people enjoyed life and all the goodness and the wholesomeness and the joy that everyone enjoyed? Why did he miss that? Either he got it wrong, or we got it wrong. I have come across personally people who say that the Buddha's teaching is very, very pessimistic. It's like the first speech he gives it on suffering. You know, everyone's like gathered around him, like waiting to hear. Come on, now we have a Buddha, finally we have a Buddha. Like after the eons of a time, of a period where there were no Buddhas, finally we have a Buddha, let's see what he has to say. Right, all the divine beings are now gathered around him. Right, anyone within earshot is now gathered around him. Right, from all the heavenly abodes, they have now descended to earth and they are now all gathered around him. And what does he say? Suffering. What a party pooper. Honestly. That's what happens when you think that dukkha is suffering. These two things are worlds apart. In fact, when you understand this, you become free from this. If these were the same, ladies and gentlemen, the understanding of this can have no effect on this. Right? When you understand pain, does that relieve you of pain? So, you know, people who study pain, what do you call them, doctors who specialize in pain medicine? Pain medicine or pain? Pain management, right? Pain management. There are consultants and doctors who specialize in this field, right? Pain management and so on. So now they understand pain. Are they free from pain? If you kick them in the butt, does it not hurt them? If they step on something sharp, does it not hurt them? Then how does that work? And here the Buddha says, if you understand this, you will not suffer anymore. You know, this is one thing where once you understand it, you don't experience it after that. So the only reason we go through an experience is because we haven't understood it. It's like an apparition. Or it's like a game of hide and seek. You know, the game is still on only until they're hidden. You play hide and seek with someone. Assume that they're under the bed. They've crawled under the bed. You're playing with your sibling. Right? Now, you see them under the bed. You haven't told them that you've seen them yet, but you've seen them under the bed. That's the end of the game, right? Would you turn around and run away again, saying, oh, where are you? Where are you? I don't know where you are. Now you've seen them under the bed, so that's the end of the game. It's like, I know I've seen you. Come on, come out. That's it. End of the game. So the same happens here. Once you've seen this, that is the end of it. What you see, you are free from. What you don't see, you have to endure. That's what you suffer from. Therefore, we are talking about a completely different kind of dukkha than what sentient worldly beings understand as suffering. This is why I am vehemently against this translation that the Buddha, the first discourse given by the Buddha was on suffering. Once you put that into the texts, right, people completely, that's a complete distortion of the Buddha's teaching. He did not give a discourse on the first noble truth of suffering. Sorry. That is not what he did. In fact, he did not give a discourse on the cause of suffering. He did not give a discourse on the cessation of suffering or the path to cessation of suffering. That is not what he did. He spoke of dukkha. We think he spoke of suffering. Assume we had another language, right? Someone speaks of something and that word is something else in another language. Right now you understand the second language and you listen to the first discourse given in another language, and now you interpret all of this as something else. Now, for example, in Tamil, Appa is father, Tata is grandfather, right? Yeah? Tata is grandfather. See, now in Sinhalese, so my Amma married my Atta, my Tata. We're like, what? They'd be scratching their head wondering what's going on there. This is what has happened. When you have different words in your language and they mean something else in another language, and then you try and understand what they meant without the actual wisdom passed down from generation to generation, and if it's just the text that it gets passed down, here's where this misinterpretation leads you completely awol and completely down another rabbit hole, sometimes to depths that you cannot come back out of again. Then, jati pi dukkha. Jati is a type of dukkha. We are all after happiness. That's what everyone wants. Everyone wants to be happy. Is it right for me to say that happiness is dukkha? I want to contrast this with pleasure. Happiness and pleasure are the two words I've written on the board. I remember the talk we gave last week. I put one of the leaves on the back of this and I turned it around and said the difference between pleasure and happiness. We spoke about this last week. Yeah? So, which one of these is dukkha? Is happiness dukkha or is pleasure dukkha? Or is neither? The simple answer to this question is dukkha, by definition, means something that is conditioned. It's a conditioned aggregate. When something comes out of aggregation that is driven by causes, that is what you call a dukkha. In fact, if you want to break this word down into its constituent parts, this kha actually means kaya. It's a body. It's a dukkha, kaya. Kaya is a body. That's why yours are called kayas. This is manusakaya, right? What do you have with you? The human body. So kaya is a word for body. What is a body, after all? Indeed, a body is a collection of parts. That's what a body is. A body, by definition, is a collection of parts. Now, when we see a pool of water, what's another word for it? A body of water. Don't we call it that, a body of water? Why do you call it a body of water? Is it one big water molecule? No, it's a collection. So, body is synonymous with collection. That is what, whenever you hear the word body, that's what it means, a collection. So then, we have dukkhaya. Khaya is body. So now you need to see that what it means here is a body, a collection of something. But this name spells out so beautifully why that collection came into being and how it came into being. What is the cause for that collection? In fact, what it says is, collections don't exist just. They exist because there's a deficiency, a void, not a void, a deficiency, a a deficit somewhere, a necessity. These are words we've exchanged in the past. Only where there's a deficiency will a collection happen. Does that make sense, ladies and gentlemen? Let's take a very simple example. This pen was not always a pen, was it? It was ink somewhere, plastic somewhere, right? Maybe a cap somewhere, a body somewhere, right? The nib somewhere. And then what happened? There was a collection, a collection happened. Now remember, when we were younger, we go around school, clubs, societies, we do a collection, hat collections. Remember that? Right? What do? When you do a hat collection, you take a hat, I mean, if you want to do it the real way, proper way, and then you go around your friends, right? And those who are only friends for now, but the moment you ask them, then they will no longer be those ones as well. And you say, hey, you know, we've got this thing, we've got this cause, right? We are going to give a donation to an old people's home, or we are going to do a refurbish a children's home, right? Or whatever, and say, please, can you contribute? See, now you're collecting. You're collecting. Collecting donations. For what? There's a cause. There's a necessity. Where there's a necessity, there's always going to be a deficiency. Because necessities aren't fulfilled automatically. Okay? Now, I really want you to pay attention. This is getting into deep Dhamma, but we take only baby steps at a time. I'm not going to take huge leaps. I could do that if I came prepared with this sermon, but that's not how it works. We do one step at a time, and each step leads to another one. This is the next one, sorry. So, therefore, you must come with me at each step, otherwise you will find me like this. You'll be here, assume you dozed off, and then we'll be down here somewhere, and then you'll have to jump and you'll break your neck as you fall. But if you come with me, then it's just a baby step, little steps. Won't be too taxing on you, won't be too difficult. It'll all make sense. So what happened when those professors came that day? They were here and we were talking here and they were like, whoa, how do we do that? Because they hadn't been coming regularly and they hadn't done any catch up online. So I want you to pay attention and come with me. Let's go on this journey together. All the more fun when we do it together. Then, where there is a necessity, there will always be a deficiency. Okay? There will always be a deficiency because a necessity is not automatically fulfilled. For example, let's say you want to eat cake. The moment you want to eat cake, now there's a necessity. Your necessity is for cake. What's the deficiency? The cake. That is a deficiency. So a necessity arises in your mind. That is, I want cake. And the deficiency? There's no cake. So the cake becomes a deficiency only when you have the necessity. How do we make this cake a non-deficiency? There are two ways to do this. One is what we always like to do, what we are very familiar with doing, which is to, you make the cake. You go buy the cake, you bake the cake, right? And then it is no longer a deficiency. Then it becomes a sufficiency. The other way is to get rid of the necessity. When there's no necessity, there are no deficiencies. So then, all these deficiencies that you experience in life, what is it all rooted in? Necessity. So now, make a mental list of all the things that are deficient in your life right now. You're like, where do we start, Swami Nuhansa? Come on. All those things that are deficient in your life right now. Be that a car, an upgrade, your phone, your, I don't know, house, swimming pool in the house, tennis court, badminton court, gymnasium, another car, whatever it is, look good. If you feel that you don't look good, then that becomes a deficiency. If you want to look good and you don't look good, that's the problem. That's when there's a problem. I assume your hair is all disheveled and you have to go somewhere. Right? Now you have a necessity to look smart. Yeah? So you go in front of the mirror to do what? To check whether your necessity is already met. If not, now there's a deficiency. So where there's a deficiency, now you need to find something to fix your hair up. Now then you scramble and you try and find your hairbrushes, your combs, your straighteners, your whatever's, hairpins, gels, right? Ha ha. All right, losers. One problem I don't have anymore. Actually, there are a few others who don't have that problem. That's the spirit, sirs. That's the spirit. Huh? That's the spirit. You didn't like that. So that's what you do. You walk in front of the mirror, stand in front, and you check whether your necessity is fulfilled or whether there's a deficiency. Right? So when there's a deficiency, what do? You quickly try and convert that deficiency to a sufficiency. That's what you do. But you step outside and assume there's a gust. There's a strong wind. Now what do? Now you have to keep maintaining it. We talked about this also a couple of weeks ago. Maintenance. I think we talked about maintenance, yeah. So you see, wherever there's a deficiency and you provide for that deficiency, it's not a done deal. It's not said and done. You know, there's never a time where you can fulfill a deficiency and go, done. That's me done. No. You can never walk away happy that you have done it. Why? Because there's always the necessity behind that deficiency. For as long as the necessity remains, these deficiencies which you will strive to fulfill by making a sufficiency will always keep going to chaos. What is nature's order? Chaos. And your order, which is at odds with chaos. See, in nature, ladies and gentlemen, there are no deficiencies. Nature has no deficiencies. And why does nature have no deficiencies? Why? Exactly. See how clever and smart you are. Because nature has no necessities. Nature is always at peace. So another word for an arahant is what? Nature. Mentally, they are at peace with whatever. Physically, yes, they feel hunger, but there's never a mental vexation about that hunger. So even if an arahant had to starve himself for days, weeks, months even, right, and then ultimately death comes to him as a result of his starvation, not once does his mind go, oh, why did this happen to me? Why am I starving? It hurts so much. This hunger, I can't bear. The mental pain and anguish that comes, that typically comes to others, it doesn't come to them. Because there's no mental necessity that has to be fulfilled by creating sufficiencies. So, you know, in life what you do every day is converting deficiencies to sufficiencies. Isn't that what life is all about? Until you come here on a Sunday morning, that is what you do when you say, I live. Transforming deficiencies to sufficiencies. Be that a physical ailment or some other issue, something that you lack at home, something that you wish you could have, whatever it is. People's lives are so complicated and so complex because they have so many necessities. And as a result of those necessities, necessities give birth to deficiencies. From necessities spring deficiencies. And then those deficiencies become your problem. Of course, once you feel a deficiency, you have to do something about it. Because the necessity keeps tugging at your heart. Then tell me, happiness and pleasure, these are the two words I have on the board. Okay, actually I was explaining to you the word dukkha. Now you see, if you can understand what I have tried to explain to you, then you will now see dukkha in a very different light. It is not to do with suffering. It is this intricate relationship between necessities, deficiencies, and sufficiencies. Do you see the relationship, this interplay between necessities, deficiencies, and sufficiencies? This word du, not word actually, this prefix, shall we call it? Is there a word for these things? Syllable, I'll call it a prefix for now. Okay, this prefix. This part itself has meaning. This has meaning. This du is deficiency. Du is deficiency. Then what is kaya? Collection. A collection. Collection for what? Indeed. To fulfill the deficiency. So this is a collection that is there to fulfill a deficiency. That is what dukkha means. We call it suffering. We call it sadness. Now you see, the Buddha says jati is an instance of a collection to fulfill a deficiency. Now we are talking. Once again, jati pi dukkha. Jati is a collection. So when you, if I could show you jati, right? Say, assume I show you that this is jati. What you would see in my hand would be a collection of stuff, whatever. Let's get later into what that stuff is. But it would be a collection nonetheless. A collection that has formed due to deficiency. That is what jati is. So you tell me then whether it is appropriate for us to simply call it birth. As in physical birth, birth of a child out of a mother's womb. You think that suffices? Do you think that cuts it? Just to say jati is birth and then of course you only go through once. That's the end of it, right? You only go through it once in your life. The moment you're out of the maternity ward, that's it, jati done. No more problems. And then it comes later again in your next life. I mean, you can't remember what happened in your previous life anyway, so who cares? Do you remember jati dukkha from your previous life? The crying and the weeping and all that, right? Suffering that you had to go through in a womb. You don't remember any of that. So what's the problem then? As long as you don't remember it, no problem. See, I'm showing you these threads, which, if you don't examine clearly and closely, people come up and give themselves as excuses to not follow the Buddha's teachings. Because they say, the Buddha's teachings are all so pessimistic, so much happiness is out there in this world, why should we bother? And Maranapi Dukkha is the same, only once in your life. And then Jarapi Dukkha comes after your... Once you start aging, Vyadhipi Dukkha is only when you're sick. So if you are young and not sick, you've already escaped the suffering of birth, you are nowhere near the suffering of death. So at that time, your youthful years, I say between, you know, once you start to understand some of this, let's say when you're in your teens, 16 to around 40, especially when you're not sick, right? At that time, life is wonderful. And the Buddha didn't say a single word about any of that. He never said not a single mention about the joyfulness of life. When there is so much to be happy about, why does the Buddha always talk about the birth, suffering, death of suffering, decay and disease? You might wonder whether the Buddha has some morbid fascination with, like, you know, this death and all things, doom and gloomy and gloomy. Then was he depressed? One might ask whether he had some depression or something like that. And that is not dukkha. So, ladies and gentlemen, a collection to fulfill a deficiency. They both start with D, so it's easy to remember. A deficiency starts with a D, do starts with a D. So, you have lokudu and podidu at home? Deficiencies, right? So, when there's a deficiency, this is what makes that a sufficiency. This kaya coming together, this collection. So actually now you see a relationship between deficiency and sufficiency. Do you see how they have to exist together? Like the two sides of the coin we talked about last week. There can never be a sufficiency unless there is also a deficiency that go hand in hand. They are complementary. Like the lock and the key. The key is of no use if there's no lock, and the lock is of no use if there's no key. So this is like the lock, and here's the key. Is there anything in this world that does not come under this banner? Anything at all? What about this? Is this not a collection to fulfill a deficiency? Yes or no? What about this then? How about this? Yes. How about this flower arrangement that you have here? Is that not a collection of whatever? Let's not worry about what those whatevers are. Is it not a collection to fulfill a deficiency? And this saucer? This microphone here? The roof above our heads? The floor beneath our feet? Your bodies? What about them? Isn't that why you eat? Why do you eat? To grow, right? If some part of you breaks, then you have to mend it, and you know that your body has a way of taking nutrients and putting it to where things are broken and fixing them, right? So there's always a deficiency, and such deficiencies can be met with sufficiencies, and so you eat to recover, to grow. So you see, we do this every day. This is the way we live our lives, yet we fail to see the reality that's just staring at us in our faces. Everything we do to fulfill a deficiency. That's what we do all day long. At work. Now, have a think about what you do at your workplace. Because it'll be different for each and every one of you. So I can't name it for all of you, right? Now, assume you work at an office and your job is to let's say prepare reports for some purpose, maybe your project reports. Would you prepare a report if there was no need for it? Although sometimes it might feel like that you're doing, that's all you do. Would you prepare a report if there was no need for it? Either your boss would ask for it, a client would ask for it, a prospective client might want it. Yeah? Maybe a donor might need it. Something like that. So there's always a deficiency which you try and fulfill by exerting energy, activity, exercise. This is what we do. And then to do this, we have to expend energy. What is energy after all? Energy is ability to do something. That is energy. When you say, I don't feel very energetic today. I don't feel like, I feel drained. What do you mean by that? There are things I have to get done, but I just don't feel like I'm able to. Right? But when you're full of energy, like little kids, primary school teachers, any here, you will know. Right? When you're kids on a Monday morning, how are they? Full of energy, buzzing, right? They just want to give all that energy out, and then you have to somehow find a way to control that. That is the ability to do something. Why do we need energy then? Why does this world need energy? See, now you are starting to ask questions or even answer questions before even asking them. Questions that you never even asked while you were at school or at university. We studied energy. We never asked why there was energy. Yeah, we studied physics, we studied chemistry, we studied mechanics, how to manipulate energy. But did you ever ask why there's energy in the first place? See, now you have you see why energy is required. Energy is required to bring these collections together. Why? Why should collections be brought? Why should there be a collection? Because there's a deficiency. If there was no deficiency, this would be obsolete. There would be no more kayas, no more bodies, no more collections if there was no deficiency. Then would there be a need for energy? This is work, isn't it? Energy is work. Work done. This is the work that we do. This is what you do at the workplace. That's why it's called the workplace. What you do at that place? You fulfill deficiencies. Your boss, when you go in on Monday, he'll say, these are my deficiencies. I will pay you to do it. Why is that phone ringing? Because there's a deficiency. Someone wants to get hold of you. Because someone wants to get hold of you, now what did they do? They picked up their phone and punched your number, right, or got you off the contact list and hit the call button. That was energy expended. Where was the call before the call was made? Where was the call before the call was made? Was it somewhere? Was it in the making? Was it up in the sky, in the ether, and somehow it just settled down into this human world? No. Because there was no necessity, there was no deficiency. Therefore, no energy was expended to produce that, or rather to manifest that. But the moment that necessity arose in someone's mind, someone who's not here, but they want to get hold of you, therefore, immediately after the necessity came the deficiency. Because they want to talk to you and you're not there. See, now back in those days, we didn't have phones. Yes, Buddha, can you believe it? There was a time where there were no phones. And then people had to wait to express their love. People had to wait to express their frustrations. And people had to wait to express their disappointment and their anger. And because they had to wait, they practiced patience. Now there's no need for that. This is how technology has deprived us of our virtues. Misuse of technology. Because now when you are impatient, actually when you need something, whenever there's a necessity, there's a deficiency. And the moment after deficiency, you just have to do this. Do the kaya, do the collection. And thanks to technology, this part has become easier. Not this part, because this is driven out of necessity. Do you think technology is ever going to help you free yourself from this, the deficiency? No, no. Here's what technology helps you do. Bring those kayas together as quickly as possible. I could explain the whole world just by this one word. And everything in this world and how everything happens. That's why the Buddha said, Sabbampi dukkha. Everything is a dukkhaya. I share this with you because I want you to start to expand your horizons and your thinking. And don't see mother, father, brother, sister, son, daughter. Reinterpret them. If you are a good student, that's what I want you to do. If you want to make every word count, that's what I want you to do. From here on, don't see houses and cars and bicycles and shops and bread and butter. Don't see music and drama. Don't see a TV and a radio, or the computer and a laptop and a tablet. Don't see parties. Go to the party, but don't see the party. See this. See, that you have to do, that is what living has to be from now on. Live mindfully. All these years of your life, ladies and gentlemen, you've lived unmindfully? No, is that right? No. Unmindfully. Mindlessly? Huh? Carelessly? I don't know. I don't know whether carelessly actually conveys the meaning. Huh? What I mean is, without being mindfully aware that this is what was going on, this is called ayoniso manasikara. Ayoniso manasikara happens when you go to the party and see the party. When you look at a sari and you see the sari, mindlessness. Thank you. When you look at a sari and you see the sari, when you see a suit and you see a suit, when you see a pair of shoes and you see the pair of shoes, do you understand that I mean see in two different meanings here? One is the physical seeing, the other is the mental seeing. When you see a car and you see a car, that is called ayoniso manasikara, or mindless living. Mindless living. You need no insight, you need no wisdom to do that. Animals are born with the innate ability to do that. Animals. I don't speak of human beings. But now I'm talking to human beings. I'm talking to individuals who have the capacity to see beyond that. To see beyond what the physical eye can see. See? Look at this for a moment. First, I want you to look at this through ayoniso manasikara. What do you see? A fan. It's an entity. It's an object. Yeah, it's an object. Now, without turning your eyes away, your eyes remain fixed on this. But I want your mind to do something now. Here's a mental activity. See if you can see this through a different lens, that this is not a fixed object, but rather this is a collection, a sufficiency that was brought to address a deficiency which came out of sprung out of a necessity. Do you see that now? Once you see that, how much can you value this? What is the value you put on this? Do you now see? See, if you can see what I've just explained to you, you realize that these things have no intrinsic value. What is the value of a diamond necklace? If you think it is a diamond necklace, now it's very valuable. Because it's a diamond. It's a diamond necklace. I mean, it's diamond. I can hear the ladies. But if you stop seeing the diamond necklace and you start seeing how there was a necessity, you know, necessities are not there to be celebrated, are they? A necessity is a vexation in the mind. It's when the heart weeps. It's when the mind cries. It's when the heart goes, I want. Help. I need. See, necessity is a need. I need. It's a cry. How can you put a value to that? How can you value that as something positive? It's when the heart is weeping. It's when the heart is hurt. That's grief. That's sorrow. And so where there's a necessity, immediately there comes a deficiency. So the moment there's a deficiency, now the whole world comes together. Then this is what business is. What is a good business? What's a good business idea? You tell me. If you're in business, you should know the answer to this. What is a good business idea? It's when you can identify, indeed, it's when you can identify a unique necessity, therefore a deficiency in the marketplace. And then you put in effort. You got to expend energy, you got to put in effort to fulfill that necessity and to uplift that necessity to a sufficiency. And in exchange for your effort, people will give you that which you are deficient in. What is that? Money or wealth. Because you have other deficiencies. You have other deficiencies and you see someone else's deficiency. So what do? You scratch my back and I scratch yours. That's how the world goes on. So thankfully people don't listen to these sermons. That's why you don't tell others about this, isn't it? See, if you were a good businessman, the last thing you ought to do is share links to these sermons with your clients. Because what would they learn if they listened to these talks? You know, for now they keep giving value. They give intrinsic value to whatever product or service that you provide. Especially products. Also services, keep it simple. Whatever products and services that you provide to them, they give intrinsic value. Because they have not seen that there's a necessity that came before this deficiency. They don't see that that is internal, that there is something that can be done about it. They think that they were born with it and therefore they have to live with it and therefore they will one day die with it. So it's what we call the human condition. It's human to have necessities. Apparently so. It's human to have urges. It's human to have necessities and desires. Apparently so. So people think that there's nothing they can do about it. So what do? They come to terms with the fact that these necessities will always be with me. The only thing that's now left to do is to go and find someone who will fulfill my deficiency. And the sooner you can get it done, the better you can get it done, the bigger the price you can demand for it. That's how business works. All explained out of one word. Sabbampi dukkha. All of existence, you can sum up in one word, ladies and gentlemen. All of existence, this entire existence and existence-related ecosystem, all the intricacies that extend out of that, all the nuances, all the nooks and the corners, all of it, this entire civilization and everything else that is part of it can all be explained with this one word. Now do you see why the Buddha was the wisest one? This is what he went looking for. That is what he said, idan dukkhan. For all these years, for all these lifetimes, and for all these eons, I went looking for what is it that makes existence happen? Here and out there. What is it that makes existence happen? What is this one principle that can explain everything? Everything, every formation, every existence. What one thing can explain all of that? And so he went to his teachers and none could explain to him. Because in everything he learned, there was some loophole. Something fell short. So he had to find it out for himself. And then he discovered it. Dukkha. This word wasn't there before then. He understood the concept. And then he came up with a word that beautifully encompassed the idea. Where there's a deficiency, there will be effort for a collection to fulfill that deficiency and therefore create sufficiency. That is with the first noble truth. Now don't say suffering. See how misplaced and misjudged it would be to say that it is the first noble truth of suffering. It is not suffering we're talking about. It's almost like the first noble truth of existence, isn't it? Then he went on to say, what is the second noble truth? Now don't say suffering again. Tanha, attachment, aka necessity. Necessity. Tanha, attachment. Attachment is the cause of du. And du is the cause of kaya. So then there would be no point really to talk about how to eradicate kaya or how to eradicate dukkha, du. Because they are both based in something else. See, do you see where the world spends most of its time and energy? Every enterprise out there, where do they spend their time? So, du is the effect of attachment, right? In other words, necessity. Yeah? Because out of necessity springs deficiency, and out of deficiency you get collections. Energy is required here. This is where the world spends its energy. So in New York City, what do they do? At the stock exchange, what do they do? On the high streets, what do they do? In Washington, D.C., what do they do? At Westminster Palace, what do they do? At Sri Jayadhanapura, in the parliament, what do they discuss? This? How to eradicate necessity? Or is it how do we fulfill people's deficiencies? See, this is what we call the world. Dukkho loke patittita. These are the Buddha's words. The Buddha said, this world as we know it, not just the round world, I'm not talking about a sphere. The world as we know it, existence as we know it, is all supported, founded on dukkha. It rests on dukkha. Dukkha is the fulcrum on which the world sits. And it makes perfect sense, does it not, to you? Because what do we mean by world? What do we mean by worldly existence? This. Spot deficiencies, exert energy to fulfill those deficiencies. Try and somehow transform deficiencies to sufficiencies. That is what we call business. That's what we call enterprise. That's what we call entrepreneurship. That's what people do. Why do we learn? Why do we educate ourselves? Why do we go to university? Why do we go to school? What do we learn? Yeah. Is that what we learn at school? What do we learn at school? This, right? How do we spot those deficiencies? And how do we fulfill them by exerting energy? See, we study natural sciences. We study human sciences. Let's take the richest man in the world. Who is it these days? See, I always have to ask, who is it these days, right? Because there's, you know, it's again one of these. That's why. Because the moment there is a richest man in this world, what does the second richest man want to do? Is this rocket science? The moment the Forbes magazine lists the first richest man in the world, what does the second richest man in the world want to do? What arises in his mind? A deficiency. So when that deficiency arises, what happens next? He'll get to work. Doing what? Collecting. Collecting what? Whatever. Whatever is needed and whatever is required to fulfill that deficiency. Therefore, number two becomes number one the following year. So now number one becomes number two. All right. So this time, what does the second number two on the list want to do? Again. Become number one again. Where's the end to this? There is no end to this. That's why every worldly being are like hamsters running this wheel. One after this, non-stop. From birth to death, ladies and gentlemen. Life is just nothing but a struggle. A struggle to do what? No, not to come first in class, not to come the richest the man in the world, not to become the most beautiful woman in the world, whatever. It's all determined by this. Whatever it is that is your do, meaning your deficiency, your life struggle is to somehow fulfill those deficiencies and create, transform deficiency to sufficiency. That is how you exert your life, that is how you spend your days. The reason you are here right now and not at some beauty pageant somewhere is because in your minds you still have not had the idea to be Miss Sri Lanka or Mrs. Sri Lanka. If that thought ever crossed your mind, maybe like right now as I mentioned it, if that thought ever crossed your mind, trust me, you would not be here. You will be wherever that has to happen. Collecting what you need, the connections, the relationships, the contacts, the training, the learning, the skills, whatever it demands, collecting all that is necessary, because you have a mind and the mind is very good at this. See, the mind is very good at studying things. It can study deficiencies. And then it can study how to convert a deficiency to a sufficiency. This is where we use intelligence, not wisdom. Wisdom comes here. This is where we use intelligence. So when you have a high IQ, what does that mean? You can very quickly spot deficiencies and identify what it is that fulfills that deficiency. Spot the sufficiency. People with a high IQ can do that. They would also be very adept at this if only they found someone who can show them that actually here's not the problem, the problem is around here. But there's a blind wall here. There's a wall here that needs to be knocked down by someone on the inside, on that side. Someone on the other side of the wall keeps screaming out at the people on this side saying, "Hey, can you hear us? There's a wall between you and me. Knock it down. And then you can come into the land of the paradise." So that can only be done by people on the other side. They can't knock it down for you, because our walls are our own. We built it. We maintain it. How can someone else knock down a wall that you build and you maintain? Because the moment they try and knock it down, what would you do? Build it back up. Isn't it? See, that's why Nibbana cannot be served on a plate. That's why Nibbana is not something I can give you. I can inspire you, I can motivate you, and I can inform you. I can inform you, I can inspire you, I can motivate you. But I can't do it for you. Because you're the one who's building it and maintaining it. How do you stop a man from committing suicide? By guarding him from others? If a man's life is under threat by someone else, now you can guard him or her. Right? But if he becomes his own threat, right now you can't even fall asleep. Assume a situation where your child, I'm sorry to bring this as an example, but I really hope you never find yourself in this place. But I'm saying this in these words, in this example, because it really hits you and you understand what I mean. Assume your child begins to have suicidal thoughts. Okay, mothers, fathers. Assume your child begins to have suicidal thoughts. You tell me, when can you sleep? When can you sleep? Okay, you can lock all the doors. Actually, you don't need to lock your doors anymore. Because these are suicidal thoughts. No one from the outside is going to attack. You lock your doors, you lock your gates, you put the cameras on, all that to protect external threats. But as a human being who needs sleep to survive, you yourself need sleep, right? You need to sleep at least an hour a day, at least a couple of hours a day. Then if your child has suicidal thoughts, how can you save them? Question. What's the answer? No answer. Because it's impossible. Likewise, if there's a wall up here, and that wall is built and maintained by yourself, I can't knock it down for you. Because any brick I take out, you will quickly replace that with another and have one for spare, just in case I take it out again. Because you will learn. Ah, here's someone who's trying to take my bricks out. Because you're very intelligent, you learn. We quickly adapt. That's why we have backup plans. See, the first time you planned for something, you didn't have a backup plan, right? Imagine when you were a kid, when you were a really, really young kid, you were playing with your brother, your sister, and you had a toy. You didn't have a backup plan. So when they took it, snatched it and ran away, you were just left crying. You went to your mother and said, don't have a toy, don't have a toy, don't have a toy. And then your mother said, Putta, don't cry, just play with one of the other ones. And you thought, actually, that's a thought. So if I always have two toys, right? When he or she takes one of them, I still have the other one. Backup plan. Ah, now you learned about backup plan. See, intelligence. In the same way, if someone tries to push you to Nibbana, in other words, take one of those bricks out when you don't want it to be done, you will bring spares just in case someone wants to take one and runs away with it. That's why Nibbana cannot happen like that. The Buddha himself says, don't push Nibbana on anyone because it won't work like that. You have to voluntarily come to Nibbana. Here's one thing in life that can only work voluntarily. Nibbana. Now, come back to this. You know, I can talk to you for days just on this one word and all its extensions and add-ons. And how, because, you know, this is existence, all summed up into one word. You name whatever, ladies and gentlemen, whatever you do in your life, you can find a thread that leads you up into this. I told you a moment ago, look at your children, don't see children. See what? See what? See dukkha, how? Is that child not a collection? A collection of stuff. You feed the child. You brought that child into this world. Right? Before you decided to bring that child into this world, they were not a child at all. They were just an egg. That's all they were. But you decided that you wanted a child. So then, out of that necessity, came a deficiency. Now I need a child. I don't have one. That's the deficiency. So then to fulfill that deficiency, you created sufficiency. And many months later, out pops the child. If that had fulfilled your deficiency, you would have stopped there. We talked about this a couple of weeks ago. Your second, third, fourth, where did they come from? See, fulfilling deficiencies does nothing to the necessity. Repeat after me. Fulfilling those deficiencies does nothing to the necessity. You are 3 times a mother now, 4 times a mother now. Your necessity is not gone yet, ladies and gentlemen. That's why another few years later, if you are born again as a human being, your necessity to be a mother will still remain intact. Unless we kill the necessity to become a mother. That can only happen in the sasana. Once necessity arises in the mind, only the sasana can uproot it. Mark those words and remember them for the rest of your life. I wouldn't be saying this if this is not true. Trust me. Once a necessity arises in the mind, okay, only the sasana can uproot it. Because a necessity is always rooted in ignorance. Ignorance can only be replaced with wisdom. Wisdom only lives in the sasana. We were all born with ignorance. And then what we did throughout our lives was we allowed ignorance to grow, arms and legs. So we were born with it, and then it just grew arms and legs. And now it's this massive beast inside each and every one of us. We can prune those branches, we can prune those limbs, but they will grow back again. That's why tanha imulang khanata, you have to remove attachment at its root. To remove attachment at its root, there's no other place but the sasana. In these talks, I will help you to do that, if that is what you want. If you don't want to knock that wall down, then I'm sorry, there's not much I can do. Why? Because even if I come and kicked a few of those bricks down, what would you do the next moment? No sooner than I kick them down, you will put them back in there like it never happened. So these dukkhas will only stop forming if and when you understand that these dukkhas are rooted in necessity and that necessity is rooted in ignorance. There's only one path out. That's why the Buddha says, Ekayanam bhikkhave maggo sattanam visuddhiya. For purity of sentient beings, there's only one path. Dukkha domanasanam attangamaya, jnanasadigamaya, nibbanasa sacchikiriyaya. To attain nibbana, to be free of sorrows and grief, to attain wisdom, there's only one path. And that is contemplation. You can call it satra satipatthana, also called mindful living. See, that's what I said. I asked you a moment ago, stop seeing a house in a house. I don't know whether you can do that, but do try. Stop seeing a car in a car. You know, I can't just say stop and you all stop. That's not how it works. It is a process. Because there's a car, and then to see a car, another process runs in your mind. Don't forget that. You see a car in a car because there's a process that runs in your mind, and that process is called ayoniso manasikara. In other words, falling victim to dukkha, not realizing dukkha. When you fall victim to dukkha, jati happens in the mind. The moment jati happens in the mind, because jati pi dukkha, jati is also a dukkha. But this particular kind of dukkha, ladies and gentlemen, jati, makes you see a car in a car. That's how you see a car in a car. Do you understand what I mean by a car in a car? Put your hand up if that didn't make much sense. When you don't see that all formations are the product of collections that are driven by deficiencies, which in turn is a product of a necessity. When you don't see that process, when you're blind to that process, then you are blind to what's in front of you. Then when you see a car, which is the physical car, you see the car, not dukkha. not the deficiency and the collection and the necessity that was behind it. See, this is a process. The car is an entity, isn't it? Do you see the process here? Ignorance leads to attachment, attachment leads to necessity, right? Leads to deficiency, leads to a collection. See, this is all a process. If you see the process, then you're seeing it. That's called insight. But when you stop seeing the process, when you have no insight, you see entities. A car is an entity. But this process is not an entity. That's what I mean by when you see a car with your physical eyes, do try and come out of seeing another car through your mental eyes. Instead, see if you can spot the process of a kaya going on there. Dukkaya. Now, what is the only place you can do this? What is the only place you can do this? At the temple. Am I right? In the Bomaluva. Huh? In the Chaitya Maluva. In the Valley Maluva. Then? Sitting down. You can't do it standing up, can you? Oh no, you have to sit down. Not like that. How? Like this. And if your knees won't let you do it, then forget Nibbana, you can't do it. And then you have to sit up, upright, straight, with your back upright. Yeah? And if your back won't let you do it, sorry, not this life, try the next one. Yeah? And you have to close your eyes. And you have to keep your head high up like this. Right? And then first you have, and then you have, if you have, your hands should lay on your knees like this. Now this won't work. This won't work. This won't work. It has to be like this. Okay? Or like this. It has to be like this. Am I right? Because that's the only way you can meditate. Contemplate, right? Then? My objective is not to mock anyone. My objective is to give you freedom. To liberate you. To take you out of these preset conceptions, preconceptions, that to practice the path, to contemplate, you have to be able to sit in a certain way. You have to find a quiet place at home. That you can only do it in the candlelight. Flashlights and tube lights, they won't do. And you have to have complete peace and quiet and pin drop silence. So if you have a baby at home who's crying, can't do. If there's a husband at home asking for his dinner, can't do. Right? If there's a dog at home barking, can't do. Right? Chores at home, can't do. Therefore, when you have this all this list of can't do's, can't do's, can't do's, can't do's, then you can never do. Because now it's too late. This is the box that people put themselves in. And they close the lid on themselves. And what do? They push their arm out and put a plaster on it as well, sellotape, so that they can't undo it and open the box again. All voluntarily done as excuses for not doing it. Or because of other ideas and things that people have completely rubbish that people have put into your heads. This is not so, ladies and gentlemen. You can do it wherever, whenever. All that is required is for you to have insight on. Just have your wisdom eye open all the time. Have it open all the time. There, you know, no one knows whether you have your wisdom eye open or not, so they, you know, people can't people can't blame you, shout at you, or accuse you. People can see what you're wearing. So at the party, wear something that is suitable to the party. Don't go like this. They will send you to the kitchen and say, go and do the clean, washing up. Or they'll say, we'll send you the dani to the monastery, upasakamma, go home. Right? That they will say. But go to the party dressed suitable, in a suitable attire for the party. But when you're at the party, don't see the party. Don't see the party. See the process. Now, let's say, does anyone of you have a party coming up soon? Yeah, no one's putting their hands up. Kapatiyas and... you Dharmishta Rajagirians. So no birthday parties, no weddings, nothing, right? Only funerals, right? In your lives now, only funerals. Okay, let's assume you have a party coming up, right? At some fancy hotel somewhere. You have to go. So you have to go dressed appropriately. So they'll say what the dress code is. Right? So if they say, come dressed in that, whatever it is, you go dressed in that. So if you had to do up your hair, you do up your hair. If you had to do your nails, do your nails. If you had to do your lips and you had to do your facial, do your facial. Do all that and then you go to the party. That's okay. Even as you do them up, right, ask yourself, why? I'm not saying meaningless, useless. This is not like this, that, you know, very... This is not that talk. This is about, think about how this is a dukkhaya. Why have they asked you to come dressed in that attire? There's a reason behind that. Because there's a necessity. To give it a certain demeanor, a certain... What's the word? Ambience, yes, a certain ambience, right? They want to give it that, and therefore you have to go dressed in that. So if they ask you to come in something glittery, then you have to go in that. So you don't fancy dress. If they ask you to come dressed in fancy dress, you go in that, right? Whatever it is, if costumes, then you go dressed in that. But as you do, because if you have to do it, you have to do it. And otherwise, you have to isolate yourself from society, like we do, and then just do what the Buddha wanted us to do. That's all we do. We do what the Buddha wanted us to do. That's all. No one comes and says, why I do that, and questions my motives, because they have accepted that I am a son of the Buddha. In fact, if I did something that was not something that the Buddha had asked us to do, then people would question me, and rightly so. Rightly so. Because you offer your arms, you offer your pirikara to sons of the Buddha, daughters of the Buddha, so that they can fulfill the path that the great father once followed himself. Right? So it's very reasonable if you question that. But that said, don't go question anyone. You can come and question me or my teacher, but don't question others, not on my account. Otherwise, if you go to wherever and you ask, Swami knows I said to question why you are doing that and doing this. Just don't say my name. Because I still have Nibbana to get done. Let me be in peace. Anyway, so when someone invites you to the party, you go to the party, you take a cake, you take a gift, you take a present, you take something, wrap it up. Do all that. But all the while ask yourself, where is the necessity? What is the deficiency? And what is the sufficiency? This energy, this exertion, this effort is fulfilling. And then you shall realize that all of this is just a dukkhaya. And then you will realize the light bulb will go off. Isn't this what the Buddha said? Everything is driven by necessity. Necessity necessity is the extension of attachment. It's a synonym for attachment. And why is there attachment then? Attachment is there because of ignorance. To shed ignorance, we need to talk about anicca, dukkha and anatta. Dukkha is one of these three. So do you see how all of this is connected then? In a few words, I'll try and sum this up. And then we will conclude for the day. It's only 11, right? What I've been talking to you about today is dukkha, the phenomenon of dukkha. Yeah? See if you can spot the irony here. Dukkha manifests because of its ignorance. Once again, dukkha manifests because of its ignorance. In other words, because we are ignorant of dukkha, dukkha manifests. So then the only way to exterminate dukkha, to cease dukkha, is to become aware of dukkha. Do you see the beauty in that? It's so fascinating, really. That to free from something, all you have to do is understand it. That's all you have to do. It's the lack of understanding, it's the lack of insight, lack of wisdom, lack of knowledge, lack of whatever you want to call it. It's a lack of comprehension of what dukkha is, that is the reason that dukkha manifests. So then the moment you realize what dukkha is, that spells the cessation of dukkha. Why? Kaya or collection is driven by deficiency. Deficiency is driven by necessity. Necessity springs out of attachment. And attachment is rooted in ignorance. What is that ignorance? Ignorance of dukkha. It's a full circle, isn't it? So the moment you realize what dukkha is, now ignorance is expelled. It's uprooted. As a result of that, no more attachment. As a result of that, no more necessity. As a result of that, no more deficiency. As a result of that, no need for a kaya. So why are we all in dukkha? Because we are yet to see what dukkha is. Then why have I been talking to you all day about dukkha? That is the reason. To free you from this, all I have to do is to help you understand what it is. Nothing more. Anicca and Anatta are also in here. Only I haven't spent a lot of time talking about it today. But the Buddha puts it very beautifully. He says, if you see dukkha, you have seen anicca and anatta. Only I have not elaborated on it. But it's there. It's already there. I can't talk about dukkha without at least subtly hinting at anicca and anatta. At least suggesting the phenomenon of anicca and anatta. Without that, you can't talk about dukkha. Because dukkha, when you explain dukkha, you're actually explaining how anicca leads to dukkha. And the fact that there is no entity here, but a collection due to causes. And that is anatta. And the fact that those things that come together, they have no bias. They have no innate necessity or need to be a certain way. It's all driven by necessity. Without necessity, there would be no need for a kaya to be like that, right? That is the phenomenon that nothing in this world has an inbuilt agenda. No bias. No affinity towards anything. That is what I mean by chaos. There is no need for order. Because in chaos there is order. Chaos is order. But the moment you bring in necessity, now that chaos is not right. Now we have to have an order that is fitting with that necessity. Therefore, what must you do? Now there's a deficiency, therefore you have to exert energy then and bring that, whatever that is in chaos, subjective chaos, this is subjective chaos, and bring that all back to subjective order. Why do I say subjective? Because it is not objective. Neither order nor chaos is objective. Order is inherently not objective, ladies and gentlemen. In other words, quite simply, there's nothing wrong with anything. So, why are you trying to fix it? There's nothing wrong with anything. Why are you trying to fix it? This is what the Buddha asks us. In plain English, this is what he asks us. There's nothing wrong with anything. Why are you trying to fix it? Just let it be. But why can't you let it be? Because there's a necessity. So if there's a necessity, how can you let something be? You know, these flowers, where were they before they landed here? Where were they? They were on a plant somewhere, on a tree somewhere, wherever. Why couldn't you let it be? You couldn't let it be because there was a necessity. Now I know there won't be any flowers from here on. That is not what I'm suggesting, okay? You can do as you wish, right? You know, whether you bring flowers here or not, I don't care. Because I come here for the flowers that blossom in your hearts. Those are the flowers I come to see, right? And their fragrance to me is eternal. These flowers will wither away and they will die. I don't care for these flowers. You can do what you like. You can beautify this place as much as you like. Remember, Swami once said, though, within reason, right? You can do what you like. But these flowers ended here because, let's say we, not you, we, all of us together, we couldn't let it be. Because we had a necessity. And out of that necessity sprung deficiency. And out of that deficiency, action, energy, effort was invested. Therefore, they were plucked. They were blossomed. And they were laid on this thing. And they were put on the table. This is a dukkha. Is it suffering? Is it suffering? No, this is a dukkha. So, the first noble truth of? Exactly. It would be wrong then to call it the first noble truth of suffering, right? This is not suffering the Buddha speaks of. It is how the whole universe hangs together. It is the theory that explains everything. All existence and its cause and its cessation and the path to that cessation. Now you must be wise to not now start writing letters to all these publishers or to the authors and ask them to correct their language and rewrite those books. Don't do that. Okay? So you might listen to another sermon by someone else another time, maybe a lay individual or a Swami Nohanse or a Silmanian Nohanse, and they might come and say, Buddha Hamdro taught us about suffering. So what must you do? Put your hand up. Silmanio. If you do that, don't come back here again. Okay? Don't come back here again if you do that. I don't want that. I just want Nibbana. The way I understand it, I will teach it to you. Who's to say that this is the only way to Nibbana? I'm not the Buddha, right? Who's to say that this is the only way to Nibbana? I'm not the Buddha. But I will teach you the way that I practice it. And for me, superficial explanations don't cut it. I need to get to the core of it. Because it has to make sense to me, and I have to be able to stand it on its own. I have to be able to do that, otherwise it just doesn't compute in my mind. It has to make sense to me. It has to make logical sense to me. And not just that, it's not enough for it to just make logical sense to me. As a result of me assimilating that knowledge, practicing it, I have to end up a better person, a better human being. If that's not happening for me, I don't want that either. Just because it makes logical sense, I don't buy it. If I cannot become a better human being, if my brothers, my sisters, my family, if people I spend time with, they think of me as a curse, they wish that I walked away and turn around and left the room, and they don't wish for my presence, if they don't like my association, then that is purely food for the brain. I need essence for the heart as well at the same time. It's because in the Dhamma I have found these two things beautifully wound together, food for the brain and essence for the heart. These two things, they sit beautifully together. That's how I know that I hit the jackpot. Okay? So do we understand what dukkha is then? Is it suffering? No. Isn't suffering a type of dukkha? Isn't suffering a type of dukkha? Of course it is. I wrote these two words on the board. Now hopefully you should be able to come up with an answer. Last week I told you that there is no such thing called happiness. Because happiness is not a conditioned existence, not an entity. Meaning, this is not a dukkha. That's why happiness need not be maintained. But pleasure is not the same. Pleasure is a dukkha. Pleasure, as you know, is a product, is an experience when you are relieved from vexation. Therefore, do you see that there has to be a vexation, which then has to be relieved, and then back to vexation, and relieved again. Without this process, you cannot have pleasure. But the moment you cease this process, now there is no happiness per se that you will find in there. Happiness is not something you find. It's a bit like dryness. Dryness is the absence of wetness. There's nothing called dryness, right? Can you bring dryness from somewhere? Can you bring dryness? Can you bring some dryness? No, but if something's wet, then you can take the water out, mop it out, sponge it out, whatever, and leave it out, right? And then after a while it'll be dry. So dryness is defined as the absence of humidity or wetness. In the same way, happiness is not some entity or some object or some experience that you can get from anywhere. It's the absence of pleasure and pain and this interaction between these two things. That's why I said it's like the two sides of a coin. On one side you have happiness, or rather pleasure. On the other side you have pain. No pain, no gain. We talked about this last week. But happiness is not there. Unconditioned happiness, therefore, cannot be conditioned. Anything that is not conditioned is just something that does not exist. That is why parinibbana is pure bliss. But you are not going to be there to experience that bliss. That is why it is called bliss. Because the experiencer, if such a thing has to exist, if an experiencer or an observer has to exist, that is a maintenance job, isn't it? And where there is maintenance, there is always going to be dukkha, dukkha, dukkha. Because, you know, this is how an experiencer is born. This is how the observer is born. To be happy, you have to exist. Because happiness has to be a kaya. And the kaya has to come out of a deficiency. And that has to come out of necessity. And that comes out of ignorance. So then what is the point of a happiness that is rooted in ignorance? Then it cannot be happiness at all. Do you see the point? So then true happiness, in other words, unconditional happiness, is not something that can exist in this world. But that does not mean that you should not aspire to it. Just because it doesn't exist. The reason you must aspire to it is because it doesn't exist. If there is something that exists, ladies and gentlemen, there is no point trying to aspire to it, because aspiration alone and getting there alone will not be done with, because you will have to keep on doing it. Does that make sense? If happiness was something somewhere, assume that it's in heaven. Even if you landed in heaven, you'd have to keep doing something to be in heaven, to remain in heaven. Therefore, if happiness was some place or some experience, some mental, physical, some combination of experience, you'd have to keep on sustaining it, keep on maintaining it, because it'll always be a kaya. Therefore, it has to come out of a deficiency, which is rooted in a necessity, which is rooted in ignorance. That's the point. That's why once you're free from ignorance, no necessity, no deficiency, no kaya. That is happiness. Unconditional happiness. Actually, it's wrong to call it happiness. There's no word to describe it. That's why the best way to put it is nibbana. Nibbanang paramang sukha. Let's leave it there. Please contemplate. Look at things, but don't see them. Got that? look at things, but don't see them. See what instead? What you have learned today. See that. Looking and seeing are very different things. All right. Let's all take a moment then to transfer the message that we have all acquired. By making offerings to the infinite virtues of the Noble Triple Gem, inviting the Swami Master to deliver the sermon, as well as creating a conducive environment for all to come along and practice the path. First and foremost, let us transfer all these merits that we have acquired to the bhikkhus and bhikkhunis, upasakas and upasikas, who have since time immemorial protected and preserved the sublime teachings of the Buddha and passed it down to generations of the Noble lineage in the form of the Tripitaka, which is thankfully available to us today to study, understand and comprehend the Dhamma. Let us take a moment to transfer these merits to the Mahanayakas, the Anunayakas of all of the chapters, as well as the monks and nuns resident in your local temples and nunneries who have always been by your side through thick and thin, come rain or shine. Let us also transfer these merits to my teacher, Guru Swami Nuhanse, as well as all the monks resident at the monastery and the Anagarikas and Anagarikas attached to the monastery. Let us also take a moment to transfer these merits to our devotees and friends of the monastery who, for the sake of merits to help them attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana, continue to sustain the Mahasangha. This includes all of you who provide the Mahasangha with shelter, alms, robes and medicines, as well as pass on your know-how and continue to extend their well wishes. May they all rejoice in these merits. Let us also transfer these merits to our mothers and fathers, brothers and sisters, sons and daughters, grandparents, uncles, aunts, cousins, nephews and nieces, our friends, our acquaintances, employers and our employees and our teachers, as well as anyone and everyone who've helped us, supported us and assisted us in any way, shape and form possible and available to them. May by the power of these merits they be healed of any physical and mental ailments and overcome any obstacles to their spiritual progress. May they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the Noble Eightfold Path, and may they all attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Let us also transfer these merits to the Devas and Brahmas, spirits and demons, primarily the Sakadeva, as well as all the numerous gods and deities who have committed and fulfilled themselves to fulfill and preserve the Sambuddha Sasana. Let us transfer these merits to our guardian deities who keep a watchful eye over us and keep us out of harm's way and prosper in divine power and wisdom. May they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the Noble Eightfold Path, and may they all attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Let us also transfer these merits to our forefathers, our ancestors, those who passed away in our name, reminding ourselves that in this infinitely long journey of samsara, reminding ourselves that it is in their blood, sweat and tears today we are able to enjoy the comforts of life and practice the path in peace and harmony. Let us also transfer this message to members of the armed forces as well as the police force who sacrificed their lives to protect the peace and harmony of our nation, as well as transfer this message to those who lost their lives in the wars, be they friend or foe. Reminding ourselves that in this long journey of samsara, they will all have supported us, assisted us in many ways and forms. Let us also transfer this message to those who lost their lives in natural disasters and calamities such as tsunamis and earthquakes, landslides, fires, floods, pandemics and so on. With an abundance of compassion and loving kindness towards all that they have, reminding ourselves that they have done so much for us in this infinitely long journey of samsara, let us transfer these merits to them, and by the power of these merits, if any of them have been born in the woeful planes, they redeem themselves and be born in the blissful plane. May by the power of these merits they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the Noble Eightfold Path, and may they all attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. And finally, may by the power and merits of all the merits, power and blessings of all the merits we have acquired throughout the day, we be able to witness the advent of many hundreds of thousands of arahants on this blessed land. And finally, may you and I and everyone who's helped make this program a success become a Rahatan Vahanse or an Arahat Theranin Vahanse in this very life itself and in the era of this Sri Sambuddha Sasana itself. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. May the blessings of the Noble Triple Gem be with you all. Members of the Mahasangha, we now transfer their blessings to you. Ragaginnen midetnva Dveshaginnen midetnva Mohaginnen midetnva Nibbana parama sukhayan Sukhita taravetva Nibbana parama sukhayan Sukhita taravetva Mamada siyalu loka siyalu satnayo Nibbana parama
සුඛයෙන් සුඛිතතර වෙත්වා නිබ්බාන පරම සුඛයෙන් සුඛිතතර වෙත්වා නිබ්බාන පරම සුඛයෙන් සුඛිතතර වෙත්වා රාග ගිනි නිවේවා ද්වේෂ ගිනි නිවේවා මෝහ ගිනි නිවේවා නිවන් සත ලැබේවා නිවන් සත ලැබේවා නිවන් සත ලැබේවා.
තුනුරුවන්ගේ සුවිසි අනන්ත මහා ගුණ බැලෙන් සියලු ලෝක සියලු සත්වයෝම නිබ්බාන පරම සුඛයෙන් සුඛිතතර වෙත්වා. සාදු සාදු සාදු.